Welcome, everyone. We will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order today. We have busy legislators here to participate today, so we will go a little bit of out of order and in and out on some of these issues. So we're going to start by opening a public hearing on House Bill 3543. Paul.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3543 changes the method of returning the 2% surplus revenue to personal income taxpayers. As you recall, this was changed in 1995 from a credit to a refund. What this bill does is eliminate the requirement Department of Revenue return the surplus revenue in the form of a refund and reestablishes the revenue be returned through an income tax credit. It does retain the year in which the percentage calculation is made. When the state went to a refund method, the percentage and the liability was based on the prior year. So if you had a kicker in 2011, it would be based on 2010 tax year. So this bill would retain that so that if it, it would still be based on that prior year. What that means is you can have taxpayers who may have liability and be eligible for a kicker in 2010, but the next year they would not be. Therefore, what the bill does is, in those cases, establishes the credit as refundable. So individuals would still be able to get a kicker even if they had no liability in the current year.
Correct, but that's status quo from the current system.
Yes, that would be a difference from the prior system when we had a credit pre-95, so it's based on the earlier year. And that also, what that does is establish certainty for the estimate of what the percentage kicker should be. Okay. The bill does first take effect, first applies to the 11-13 biennium. So if there was a kicker following the biennium, it would take effect in the fall of 13.
Okay. Representative Parrish, you want to say a few words about this since it's your bill?
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I won't take up too much of your time because I know you have a full schedule behind me. Julie Parrish, representative from House District 37, Westland Tualatin. And really, this came forward because I was sitting at my kitchen table when we distributed out the last kicker check and read an article in the Oregonian talking about just how much it actually cost us to do the process of sending back a check. 1979 legislative intent on the kicker was that it was a credit. The 1995 legislature changed it to a check. That it came with some additional costs and some unknown, unforeseen things like borrowing charges because the kicker is distributed outside of our current cash flow cycle by giving it back in December versus following the way our money comes in and out. So this doesn't speak to that we should or shouldn't get rid of the kicker or do anything with the kicker other than putting it back the way it was, untangling something that was had some unforeseen consequence that cost the state some additional dollars that we didn't need to expend. You know, my license plates say Coupon Queen, so I'm all about saving money. And $27 million between interest and administrative costs is a savings. And whether we do anything else with the kicker, another question for another bill, but this one simply just says, let's save money where we can save it, and I'll take $1 million here and $1 million here because those are little drops in the bucket that do add up. In the year that we gave back the last kicker, the kicker triggered about $150 million federal liability, so 15 cents on every dollar actually went back to the federal government, left Oregonians with a little over $850 million net kicker return. Oregonians are also very generous. I think they feel like they know what to do with their money. Oregonians in that same year donated $2 billion on their 1040s. So it's not like they were out there necessarily all buying big screen TVs. I think a lot of folks did good things with their money. So I'm not going to advocate for one position on what else we do with the kicker other than save money with it where we can. And this is a good, easy way to put some dollars back in should we have another kicker that's triggered that people will still get a refund check if they don't owe anything to the state. You can file your tax return, I think, as easy as the second, third week of January, so from a December check to a January filing. Because my husband was deployed this year, I actually got a little bit of a refund to the state from the state, e-filed mine, and I got my check back in 5 days direct deposited. So it's not like we're asking folks to wait too much longer. It's not like we're sitting there taking their interest and hoarding it and using it for other things. We're actually not borrowing the money, but by putting it back in the regular tax cycle. So that's all this bill asks. And if that's all we get to on kicker reform, then that's good enough for me. So,
take questions Representative Parrish. Okay,
thank you
very much.
Appreciate the time today.
Okay, we will recess the public hearing on. We'll recess the public hearing on House Bill 3543 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 984.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, this bill gives the gives a local government flexibility in financing the cost of an unemployment insurance.
Okay, that's it. Okay, Senator Starr, you're on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here really just to introduce a couple of folks that can explain the circumstance that brings this bill to us. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr, State Senator from Western Washington County, Senate District 15. It wasn't but maybe a month ago when I got a phone call from Don Otterman, who's the city manager at North Plains, about a concern, an issue that North Plains has as it relates to the amount of money that they spend in their budget every year for unemployment insurance. And so I brought Don to the Capitol, and I brought in Lori Warner from the Employment Department to see what we could do. And Senate Bill 984 is the result of that effort. I really appreciate you hearing the bill. It does create a small fix for a predicament that the city of North Plains finds themselves in. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn the microphone and dais over to Don Otterman from North Plains, who can briefly, I think, explain the situation that North Plains finds themselves in. And then we have Rob Edwards from the Employment Department to basically further explain the fix that you see in Senate Bill 984. I think it's simple. I think it's something that's easily fixable. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Otterman.
Great. And Senator Starr, if you need to leave,
thank you. I appreciate
that. Are there questions before he leaves? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Otterman.
Thank you, ma'am. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Don Otterman, City Manager, City of North Plains. For those of you that don't know about North Plains, we're a city of just under 2,000 population. We're located directly north of Hillsboro. We have a total of 12 full-time employees. Our unemployment history has been stellar. We have had very few claims over the years since we've been incorporated. Our assessment for the current fiscal year was a total of $3,162. However, we had an anomaly that occurred just recently where we had three former employees collect unemployment. And because of that, our employment account was overdrawn. The state law requires that if the unemployment account is overdrawn, that the city pay a special assessment over a period of one fiscal year to bring the balance in the account back to zero. So we were faced with a special assessment that will have to be paid in 2011-12 of a total of $12,000, just a little bit over $12,000. So we have the special assessment because because it has to be paid in one fiscal year of $12,000. In addition, our unemployment contribution rate has been recalculated based upon history. And we're looking at an unemployment rate or an unemployment contribution for the next fiscal year of over $39,000. And so the combination of the $12,000 special assessment and $39,000 rate for this year brings our unemployment contribution to over $50,000 this next fiscal year. Again, it's because of two things. One is because the special assessment is required to be paid in one fiscal year. And the second is that because of the history, our rate has gone up. And there's no recalculation of that rate during the next fiscal year. It's only set once during the fiscal year, and because of our recent history with having nobody on unemployment and not having anybody on unemployment for quite some time now, for at least a year or about a year, we're looking at paying an assessment of $39,000 and probably at the end of the next fiscal year getting a refund of quite a bit of that. So we're looking at having to pay over $50,000 in the next fiscal year just to be able to get some of that back at the end of the next fiscal year. And this bill would fix that. I will leave it to Rob Edwards to explain the technical changes in the law, but this would enable us to spread our special assessment out over a period of up to 3 years, and it would also allow us to have our unemployment rate recalculated during the current fiscal year. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Edwards, and then we'll take questions.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Rob Edwards. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division for the Employment Department. And just to give you a little background, what we're talking about here is a program called the Local Government Employers Benefit Trust Fund. There are currently 277 local governments participating in that program, so we're not talking about a high volume of governments in the program at the moment. What it is a hybrid between reimbursing the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund for UI claims have been paid, and regular tax paying. And Mr. Otterman actually explained it pretty well. Each year we calculate a tax rate for a local government participant. They pay into their own reserve account the amount that was calculated. If at the end of the fiscal year the payouts on claims exceeds the amount that was paid in through that tax rate, then they have to reimburse over a one-year period. What the bill does is it makes two changes. It first changes the calculation so that we can do it more often than annually. And what that will do is address anomalous payments, as you heard Mr. Otterman describe from the City of North Plains, so that if there is a large payout of claimed money, and then the rest of the history goes back to its normal lower status, we can recalculate the rate at a lower value than it had been. The other piece is extending the repayment of the negative balance from 1 year to 3 years, which actually brings us into line with what the state of Washington has for their very similar program. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
How long has this kind of hybrid program existed for local governments? Because I'm surprised this hasn't come up before.
Madam Chair, it's been in place at least... Well, I recall it in 1981, so at least 30 years. I think the reason that we've just seen it is because of the very bad economic situation where we have people drawing out UI claims for vastly longer than they ever have before. And so it's probably a function of the economic conditions.
Okay. And then we don't have a fiscal statement on this yet. Do we have a fiscal statement on this yet?
No,
I don't think we do, but it won't lose or gain any money.
Madam Chair, no. The only possible impact it might have is we do make interest on the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, so money that isn't in that fund because we're allowing a longer repayment period, we could lose a little bit of interest on that, but it's going to be very, very minor amounts. If you think about the total universe of employers in this program is 277, then you reduce that by the number that have a negative balance, then you reduce that to the number that are going to take 3 years to repay. We're actually not talking about very many employers.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much. Scott Winkles. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in support of Senate Bill 984. I really don't have much to add to the excellent testimony of City Manager Don Otterman and your previous panelists, other than to say this is not an issue that is unique to the City of North Plains. We're hearing from other members who are experiencing similar concerns right now. To Senator the Chair's question in regards to why this issue hadn't come up before, I hadn't even heard of this until a couple of weeks ago. Cities had previously been rather stable employment opportunities for folks. So doing significant layoffs and is not something that it's sort of new to some of our membership. We're sort of in uncharted territory, but I suspect the situation will become somewhat worse as local government finances continue to deteriorate.
Thank you. On that bright note, other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the... I don't have anybody else signed up. Is there anybody else who wants to talk on this? Okay, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 984, and we will open our informational hearing on general fund cash flow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think some of you have participated in discussions around cash flow in the past. The state has been monitoring its general fund cash flow over time. There have been some very significant changes in the timing pattern of our expenditures from the general fund and also the timing of our revenue. And one of the issues that did affect the timing of our revenue was the switch to a refund for the 2% surplus kicker. We've asked Mark Menema from DAS and Darren Bond from the Treasury to come and go through the cash flow issues around the general fund and also the issuance of tax anticipation notes, which was an authority the Treasury got in 2002, I think.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Darren Bond, the Deputy State Treasurer. I'll start out and give a little bit of background on why we have the issue, and I'll talk from paper since apparently our electronics are behind us. If you go back, back to the dark ages, the special sessions days before we really had a general fund cash flow issue. I remember the days, Paul will remember the days, we never even talked about cash in this building. All we talked about was budgets. Nobody cared about cash. With Measure 5 and Measure 50 and the various pressure that's been placed on the general fund because of that, those changes, and because of the way we have changed some of the expenditure patterns, there's been more pressure put on the general fund, and we have saw a need to look for better alternatives to manage our cash flows. If you look at that chart up there, you'll see the blue line shows the structural deficit that Oregon's general fund faces. Back in those good old days, before we had changed things, we used to be able to carry significantly larger beginning and ending balances, which, as you can imagine, just moves that blue line up. Additionally, through the changes we made in how taking on a larger role funding schools, we have created a situation where we are now more front-loading our expenditures with our revenues coming in more of a back-loaded basis coming in at the end of the biennium. That creates that structural deficit, and that's the reason that we're going to have to borrow TANs forever, as far as I can tell. Now, of course, we do have the benefit when we borrow tax anticipation notes that we're borrowing in a tax-exempt market, and when we do have positive balances from that, we're investing those balances in a taxable market, so we do have that arbitrage play. But there is, of course, a cost to the borrowing. One thing that you might want to think about as you have your discussions about kicker reform and rainy day funds is there is the potential to have, because we have the rainy day fund and or whatever kinds of rainy day funds we may have as it's modified, and we have the potential to have that in the general fund, that does have the potential to act as a significant substitute for a beginning and ending fund balance. And that money could be available to mitigate against the needs of borrowing tax anticipation notes in the tax-exempt markets. And so that's one thing. The way we currently have it structured, it doesn't work that way. I believe the way the language and the bills in play currently wouldn't allow for that kind of activity or that kind of a substitute effect. But there is the potential, if we created it the right way, that we might have an opportunity to avoid those borrowings. And that's kind of my history lesson and where we are today. And don't get me wrong, I'm more than happy to issue tax anticipation notes for you. But
well, and that also assumes there's actually something in the fund.
There is that, yes.
All right.
Okay. For the record, my name is Mark Miedema. I work with the DAS Budget and Management, Chair Burdick and members of the committee. As Mr. Bond explained, this is kind of the cash flow without the tax anticipation notes. And then if we go to the next page, this is really the actual cash flow. These are estimates basically after May of 10. But because we borrowed $750 million of TANs early in the biennium, you see the big increase in the July there. And then we work on that. And because of some tax code issues and the appropriation bonds or the deficit funding in 2003, we don't carry TANs over past a fiscal year. So the big negative you see there basically is moving it back to the prior one without TANs, because we've paid off the first set of TANs, and then we had them structured so that July 1 of 2010, we borrowed another $850 million. So you see the big increase, and then you can kind of see that with that money in there, we stay above the zero mark using those TANs to basically shift up the cash flow. And then at the end of the biennium, we pay off that $850 million, and then you'll see that the estimated balance is at the same spot as it was on the prior sheet without TANs, you know, from that money coming in. And further back in the information you have, I won't try and blind you with the small numbers, but what I did was I pulled the numbers display, because when we do the tax anticipation notes, we have to provide a cash flow to investors to show that the money would be repaid. And so the font there is pretty small because we have a lot of information to display, and we try and keep it on one page. But for anybody who's really interested in the technical stuff there, you can look at those numbers. The one thing I will point out that's different is those numbers actually show some negatives, and there are times, even when we borrow TANs, that we get into the interfund borrowing. And so where you see negative numbers in there, we're actually using interfund borrowable resources, which is how Treasury funded the deficit before we did the TANs. But like I said, I took out that interfund just so that you can kind of see when those negatives actually occurred. But from a realistic standpoint, there's never a negative. There's always about an extra $15 billion at the Treasury to kind of act as a backstop. I know there's a whole lot more detail, but I guess at this point I just open it up to any questions you might have.
Okay, well, this is useful because it kind of puts into context the issues that surround the current system of writing out those kicker checks when you don't have revenue there.
Exactly, Madam Chair. I think you can see how that, if you'd issued a kicker refund in here, how it just further exacerbates the negative balances that are at play.
Whereas if the kicker is sent out in the normal course of things as a refund, then that you've got that going out at the same time the money's coming in. So
it would mute the impact.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions?
That's the 07.
Oh, right. Yeah. I see a lot of negative numbers in 07.
This is October and November of 07.
Those big negative numbers.
Yeah.
We're just looking at the negative over 800 in October of 07 and negative 400 in November of 07, which was the
contribution
last time
of the last kicker.
Yes, the last kicker, yes.
All right. Questions?
All I can say, Madam Chair, is too bad it's just the Revenue Committee that looks at this. We continue to kick this whole issue down the road on stability, and I could say more, but it wouldn't be kind.
Yes, we're reaching.
Thank you for this information.
Yeah, thank
you. Just reinforces the lack of fiscal discipline and dedication to stability that exists in this building. It's a disgrace. Excuse me for being so.
I would like to associate myself with Senator Morse's remarks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think the one thing it does point out, to those of us who are just the lowly bureaucrats and not the policymakers, is that we don't seem to have a very big and thoughtful discussion about these issues. We tend to look in isolation at certain aspects of it. Having the kicker, the idea that the kicker needs to earn interest. Fundamentally, that's not a very sound process, the way our cash flows is managed and the way the general fund interacts, and keeping in mind we have our two separate general funds, the appropriated general fund and the legal general fund, and I can talk to where I'm tired of listening to myself, let alone you people have to do. But the fact of the matter is there are much more thoughtful ways for us to go about putting these things together so we can address these kinds of issues. And you're right, somehow, hopefully someday, we can get to the point where we can have that discussion.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, we are going to now we're going to reopen the hearing on House Bill 3543. Paul, do we have any witnesses signed up? Burl, anyone want to testify? Okay, well, we heard from Senator from Representative Parrish, and so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3543. And open a work session on House Bill 3543. Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3543A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris has moved House Bill 3543A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Hass.
Thank you, and I do want to thank the sponsors of this bill for bringing it forward. There's a mystery to me, not that we're doing it now, but why we hadn't done this in previous sessions. It's just amazing to me that we've let this go this long. And even having said that we're really just looking at taking care of a symptom of a much larger problem that we're so far unable to cure.
Well said. Comments?
I better not say any more.
Okay. Senator Morris has been rendered mute. There is no objection to the motion, so it is sent to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. I will carry it.
Now, you trust me to carry it, Madam Chair?
If you would like to carry
no,
it.
No, I'm just, I'm having
we,
fun.
We will be, I would be more than happy, or
no,
you, Senator
no,
Hass.
No.
Could be an interesting floor discussion.
Yes.
Now we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3017.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3017 will extend the sunset date for enterprise zones from June 30th, 2013 to June 30th, 2025. This moves the sunset date for a business to obtain new authorization for an exemption under the enterprise zone for property tax. For long-term rural enterprise zone, this measure changes the date for the property tax exemption from June 30th, 2013 to June 30th, 2025, which is the same span of dates. The measure in the House received an amendment that removed the sunset extension for the income tax credit associated with the long-term rural enterprise zones And it, so that it would sunset at June 30, 2012, but I believe that income tax credit is being evaluated by the Joint Tax Committee. The revenue impact of this measure is in 2013-15 expected to be a small amount of the $62.1 million that has spent on enterprise zones due to just some zones or some exemptions expiring in that time, and it will be progressively higher until it reaches $62.1 million. And there is a minimal expenditure impact for a fiscal impact statement on this measure.
Okay, it looks like we have Representative Conger and his team on board here.
You want the whole team to come up?
Absolutely.
I'm not sure what kind of testimony you'll get, but.
Welcome.
So just to make sure, because I didn't hear on the way in, this is House Bill 3017, correct?
Correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Jason Conger, representing House District 54, and I deeply appreciate you taking the time to hear this bill, and I look forward to hopefully working it soon. What are enterprise zones? I'll just do a quick summary. I think probably most of this will be redundant, but I'll skim over the top at least. The enterprise zone program, although it's linked to a bunch of other tax credits and everything, I think 3017 only deals with a core enterprise zone program, and it provides an unusually effective and relatively inexpensive economic development tool to communities with low income or an unemployment rate that's at least 2% higher than the average for the whole state. So they're a focal point. Enterprise zones are a focal point for economic development. They can be no more than 12 square miles in size, and they have to cover an area that is experiencing or can be demonstrated to be experiencing economic hardship. They're applied for or sponsored by local government entities, so they have to have a municipality or a county or a tribe. I think a port can also sponsor them. And they have to be approved by Business Oregon, our state economic development agency. The approval period for enterprise zones is 10 years, and then they have to reapply. So the criteria still have to be met to go beyond a 10-year period for the existence of the enterprise zone itself. What are the criteria? 50% or more of the households must have incomes below 80% of the Oregon average income, or the unemployment rate within the enterprise zone must be 2% higher than the state average, as I mentioned. The costs are... they can vary a little bit, but in exchange for locating or expanding within an enterprise zone, an eligible business, which is generally non-retail traded sector companies, receive a total exemption from property taxes normally for 3 years, although it can be up to 5 years under the core program if they meet certain higher criteria. Welcome, Representative Bailey.
Thank you.
I saved your seat for you.
Appreciate it.
And again, as I mentioned, although obliquely, businesses that locate or expand within enterprise zones can become eligible if they meet the proper criteria for other programs and other incentives that we're not dealing with in HB 3017. Since they're sponsored by local governments, enterprise zones are really a classic example of local control in action because they require the local community to invest to identify the need and then to invest in applying and managing the enterprise zone. And they work. The impact of enterprise zones can be felt statewide. The statute, I believe, authorizes a maximum number of sponsored enterprise zones. I think it's 59, although, yes, it's 59. And that is the maximum number available under the statute. So communities are taking advantage of this statute. They're using it, and they are having success. According to Business Oregon, 2009-2010 exemptions, so it's only for that biennium, resulted in 163 projects, $1.8 billion in invested capital, and over 6,500 new jobs. That's the key, is that a business to qualify for an enterprise zone property tax exemption has to create new jobs. It can't be replacing other ones. And so that translates to a cost of about $3,192 per job. Which compares extraordinarily favorably with most government stimulus programs. And to close, actually, I have a bunch of other statistics, but I think I'm going to skip them. The point is that this is a very effective program. It has a fairly significant amount of history in the state of Oregon. It's been characterized to me as the most effective, maybe the only effective tool available in the economic development toolbox for local economic development efforts. And I just want to make it local. For me, it's extraordinarily important. We have four enterprise zones that I'm aware of in Central Oregon. One very recently created in Bend has already had its first project constructed, which was featured in the Oregonian yesterday, I think. Redmond, as an enterprise zone, has been around for quite a while, and it has 122 businesses. It has created over 1,700 jobs and has $127 million of capital investment over its history. It's extraordinary. We need jobs in Oregon, so I urge you to work this bill and appreciate your time very much.
Thank you, Representative Conger. Are there questions? Your team is crawling on the audience, so if you would like to go, you can. And if you'd like to stay, you can.
Thank you very much. I will take my team and exit gracefully. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you for coming. Welcome, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jules Bailey, representing House District 42. My friend and colleague, Representative Conger, I think hit many of the important points. I'll just supplement with a few of the issues that were discussed in the committee on the House side, as well as why I've chosen to put my name on this bill. I do think it's a very important bill. I think Representative Conger appropriately hit the fact that this is really about a local option and about local control. It's a local application that happens, and what that means is that in addition to the standards that the state imposes on enterprise zones, local governments can actually choose to put their own standards on top of an enterprise zone application. The one with which I am most familiar, the enterprise zone in North Northeast Portland, for example, has a first source hiring agreement that goes into an enterprise zone application. It has a local sourcing component to it. So even if you might hypothesize that the businesses that are using it might make the investment they were making anyway with the enterprise zone, you're also getting on top of it these local purchasing and local hiring add-ons that have a direct economic benefit to the locality. However, research suggests that it does have an effect and passes the but-for test, and that enterprise zones not only affect the size of the investment, it has the potential to affect some combination of the size, the timing, and the location. I'll give you an example. I visited a business in the North Northeast Portland Enterprise Zone area that uses large, very expensive plasma cutters to cut very large pieces of steel that then go on what are called MRAPs. These are the vehicles that we are deploying in Iraq that are some of the vehicles that are more impervious to improvised explosive devices in Iraq. A lot of the steel that goes on these vehicles is actually cut and made here in Oregon. These are very expensive pieces of equipment. And what we heard when we visited the business was, were they going to put in a few plasma cutters? Yes, they were going to put in some plasma cutters. But because of the enterprise zone, they could afford to get the financing to put in a couple more. And that meant an additional expansion faster than what they were able to do. That money and that property tax, when the program ends, then rebounds back to the county in a way that it might not be there otherwise. I want to address very quickly the timing of the extension. There's, I believe, 12 years in this bill. The reason for that is that this is a 10-year application program, and often what localities will do is go through that 10-year period, then do an evaluation of whether or not it's worth it. Do they need fewer add-ons, more add-ons? Did they get what they wanted to get out of it in the way that they structured it? And then choose to make a reapplication under the program for an additional authorization for an enterprise zone. So 12 years seems to make sense to allow the application cycle to complete for the enterprise zone, give them a chance to do the evaluation, and then choose to make a recommendation on reapplication or an extension of the program. That's why that 12 years is in there. And with that, be happy to take any questions.
Thank you for coming. Questions for my colleague was called to the president's office, so that's a command performance.
Absolutely.
It looks like there's no questions. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Senator. I'll be in another committee, but happy to come back if there are any further questions.
Great. We will text you. Okay. As a courtesy, this committee always gives priority to people who've come 100 miles or more, and I have three of those signed up: Jason Carr, John Stark, and Steve Dahl. And then we will hear from Representative Comp's office, who will be speaking. So if those three of you could come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm John Stark, manager for Redmond Economic Development. We do economic development activities for traded sector businesses in Redmond, Oregon. We're made up of a board of 24 members that represents a cross-section. I provide a list of those members who have supported this bill for me to be here today. Provided that in our written testimony. I'll try not to duplicate anything you've heard already in my thoughts and remarks today, but a couple of things I thought I might add about this Enterprise Zone program. Representative Conger did share that this is an effective tool. Definitely feel that that is an accurate statement. When we're competing against other states offering cash incentives at times, this particular program does allow us to offer some savings in terms of property tax abatement. The program runs 3 to 5 years for the standard enterprise zone. In that situation, obviously companies make investment, and that investment would be abated for that 3 to 5 years. So revenue is impacted by the state only for that 3 to 5 years and doesn't include land. So there still are revenue opportunities for these businesses expanding and relocating for the state, both in the jobs that they create and in the capital investment that comes onto the state's revenue after that 3 to 5 years. Those early years are important and critical to these businesses that expand. We've had a number of projects that Representative Conger had noted. This program's helped over 122 businesses. One of those businesses is the fastest growing company in Redmond right now. Medisys, which is a medical device reprocessing company here, just did an expansion. This is the second time they've used the Enterprise Zone. They added 12,000 square feet onto their existing building, and that capital investment equals near doubling in size of their jobs. So they were 35 people when they first used the Enterprise Zone. They're going to surpass 100 on their way to over 150 this next year. So company is certainly accelerating in terms of job creation. You know, one of the things that we certainly believe, not included in my written testimony, is that this particular program, it's not a new program. It's been available in Redmond since 1988. We just redesignated it for another 10 years in 2008. And with that, we've got a number of projects that are interested in using the zone going forward. Because this is not a new program, nothing new has to be created. And so what I'd ask you to do is consider our support in your decision of this particular bill. And let's help create additional jobs and capital investment in Oregon and tell Oregon companies, those that are here and in the future, that Oregon is open for business. Thank you, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. We'll hear from the others and see if there are questions. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Carr, employee of Economic Development for Central Oregon. I manage the Prineville-Cook County office. Wanted to hit mainly on some of the local applications and what we have seen in activity because of the Enterprise Zone. Unfortunately, one of the things that Cook County leads the state of Oregon in is unemployment, and right now our rate is at 16%. And as I think many of us understand, rural Oregon communities have a much more difficult time in recruiting companies, especially lack of infrastructure and other items that are not available to them as they are in more urban areas. And so the Enterprise Zone becomes a very unique and important opportunity for us to help recruit in other companies that may not otherwise consider rural Oregon. And the Enterprise Zone basically creates that competition for us and allows us to be able to say that we have something here that may benefit a company and allow them to relocate. A couple of things that I wanted to mention have to do with recruitment and then expansion and retention. The most recent project that utilized our Enterprise Zone in Prineville and Kerr County was the Facebook project. And while the community had some assets in place to allow for that data center to be built, I can tell you unequivocally, having been involved with those negotiations and in that project from the beginning, that the Enterprise Zone played a very important role in Facebook locating into that community. A couple of numbers I want to hit on there. Since January of 2010, there have been over 1,300 construction jobs that have been created. While Facebook did hire some local contractors and subcontractors out of state, many of our local union members and other contracting folks were local, hired locally. In fact, Facebook estimates about 90% of the actual workers are from Central Oregon. 35 full-time employees are existing in the facility right now, and the second half of the building is still under construction. So we anticipate probably upwards of 50 to 60 employees when it's all said and done that'll be in that facility. And so, as you can see, this project has created a lot of construction activity, a lot of investment in our community that otherwise would not have been there. And Facebook is utilizing the long-term enterprise zone, which is a 15-year tax abatement, 7 to 15 years, which was approved unanimously by both our city council and our county court, who are both sponsors of the enterprise zone. In terms of local companies, since I have been in this position since June of 2007, I have helped a total of 14 companies, including Facebook, so 13 other companies, most of which have been local existing companies in Prineville that have benefited from this program. $12 million in capital investment, 84 new jobs created, and I think most importantly, about 145 of those jobs have been retained. In fact, I would say that most of those companies have not laid off employees when the recession hit, which is pretty good news in a community like size like ours that has lost a lot of jobs in the wood products and construction industry. So I think it goes without saying that the impact on our community, being a rural community in Oregon, has been substantial, and I would ask that you would support House Bill 3017 to extend the enterprise zone.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Steve Dahl. I do economic development for the city of Grants Pass. And what I'd like to do is do two quick stories of how this has affected the city of Grants Pass recently. The first one is Jefferson State Forest Products. They were a company looking to move out of Northern California and had to decide between going to Olympia, Washington, or Grants Pass, Oregon. They decided on Grants Pass because of the whole incentive package that included the Enterprise Zone tax incentive, along with some financial benefits sponsored by the City of Grants Pass and Josephine County. They relocated to Grants Pass on January 2011 and brought in an estimated $200,000 in new real property investments to the area. Since January, Jefferson State has hired 17 people. This year, Jefferson State Products will bring in $36,480 in new payroll into the Grants Pass area. New personal income tax credit for the state of Oregon equals $31,824. The cost of the state business income receipts, zero. Now, in 2009, we had an expansion of First Call Resolution. They were a Roseburg-based company. They wanted to expand. They compared two areas, Grants Pass, which had an enterprise zone, and a city which did not have similar benefits. First Call Resolutions decided to move to Grants Pass, citing the enterprise zone along with the e-commerce overlay as a reason. Since July of 2009, First Call has hired 173 employees. First Call generates $3,590,400 in new annual payroll in Grants Pass, along with $250,000 in new property investment. First Call's annual payroll generates new personal income tax for the state of Oregon per year on the amount of $179,200. Cost of state business tax, because of the e-commerce overlay of it, is $62,500. The net profit for the state, because the enterprise zone exempt for the next 3 years because of this, is $463,850. Two times in the last 4 years, Grants Pass City Council voted in favor of the enterprise zone. In 2007, to renew the Grants Pass Enterprise Zone, and again in 2010, to consolidate the Justine Champion and Grants Pass Enterprise Zones into the Rogue Enterprise Zone. Since the inception of the very first Enterprise Zone, the Enterprise Zone has helped create 911 new jobs, 2,740 jobs retained, and an investment of $54,905,259. The enterprise zone works because it's a local incentive, approved locally, that acts as a profit center for the personal income tax of the state of Oregon.
Thank you. You mentioned the e-commerce overlay. And
yes.
we're also going to be considering in our joint committee a bill on that. Since I have you here and you're from Grants Pass and you use that overlay, could you just say a little bit about how that specific e-commerce overlay has worked?
It has worked in Southern Oregon tremendously. In fact, I think if you take a look at how Southern Oregon has one of the highest concentration rates of e-commerce companies in the state of Oregon. Motorcycles USA is in Medford. First Call Resolution, Fire Mountain Gems, if you like beading, has all used the e-commerce overlay on that. Fire Mountain Gems has grown from a mom-and-pop company in their backyard to a company that's over 560 employees right now in Grants Pass. So, it's been a very effective program for us because it's been able to get businesses excited about coming in here. We have a lot of internet businesses that are starting up around the area, and the cost to us has been minimal compared to the amount of people that they hire.
Chair Burdick, we're also e-commerce, if you'd like some comments from our region.
Please do.
City of Redmond Enterprise Zone, Greater Redmond Enterprise Zone also has this e-commerce provision on it. We have two very fast-growing companies that use this. One is predominantly an e-commerce business. They're an online clothing retailer. That company came to us and used the Enterprise Zone, Standard Enterprise Zone, for their first relocation out of the Washington area. And now they've used it with the e-commerce provision in it for their second, which is an expansion for them. They've grown to nearly 100 employees. They employ close to that in addition as seasonal workers. This program has actually helped this company expedite some of those hiring processes. Instead of paying money into property taxes or income tax with the e-commerce provision, they've been able to expedite hiring and use some of that money for inventory control. So it's definitely a piece that is very effective for us for recruitment and expansion in Redmond.
Okay, thank you. And
thank you.
These truly are overlays. They tend to be in the same place as
yes,
the
ma'am.
Overall.
Yes, ma'am. The enterprise zone that for the Rogue Enterprise Zone, what we did, the Josephine Champion Enterprise Zone, which was originally done back in 92, mm-hmm. did not have the e-commerce overlay on it. And we were able to, and that was the reason we wanted to combine the two zones, was to be able to get rural areas of Josephine County to have that e-commerce overlay, mm-hmm. because a lot of those companies are in rural Oregon, if you're going to sell to somebody, a lot of times you have to sell over the internet, mm-hmm. and have an incentive to help you to do that so you can hire your neighbor at, for 280 hours a week at minimum wage, that still is a job. And when you heard from, not Redmond, but I'm sorry, I blew it.
Prineville,
at 16% unemployment. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with 12 to 18% unemployment on a regular basis, a job, even if it's $10 an hour or minimum wage, is a positive increase for that area. Because let's take an example of the First Call Resolution that came in there. Well, they're in our downtown of Grants Pass, and that's getting 100 people on a day into our downtown area. We are now having shops that have been closing in downtown reopening. We have gone from having about 8 empty buildings in our downtown to having 3 that I can think of off the top of my head. So not only is it effective in the point of it works to get people hired originally, but the downstream, the multiplier effect to the other businesses in the area, $3 million in a rural community is a lot of money to have come in from the outside sources. And it's the most effective thing we can do, and it's redoing our downtown by having people encouraging to open new businesses downtown to serve the people that work at First Call Resolution.
Thank you. Anything from Prineville?
Yeah, I would just like to mention, obviously, without divulging details, is that because of Facebook's presence in Prineville and their open source network, sharing how they built the facility and being the most energy efficient data center in the world, is they've had numerous companies come through that, and because of that, it's created more activity where we are currently working with some possibilities of other data centers locating in our area. So I just wanted to mention that because I think it shows again the importance that the Enterprise Zone plays in our recruitment efforts, and the fact that some of these companies are looking, knowing that that incentive exists.
And you're talking about the e-commerce?
I'm sorry. No,
well,
I'm talking about just the long-term enterprise
yes.
zone. Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much. Questions? And I'm sorry, Hess. Senator Hess?
First call is a call center.
Yes.
I'm supportive of the bill, so don't take these questions wrong. But what is the salary of a person who starts there?
The salary starts at $8.50 an hour, and usually within the first 60 days, they get a 25% raise, and after they've been a year, it gets a $10 an hour. But with First Call, it's one of the better call centers I've dealt with. They do have benefits after the first 6 months, and if you've been 2 years, you get profit sharing. So the people up in Roseburg who have been there for 3 or 4 years now, they're pulling in $14 to $15 an hour. And where it's been really important is the benefits side of the equation. You know, if you're coming from a rural area, having a hospital within a day's drive is an important part of things. And being able to have benefits into that hospital so you don't have to come up with it, because a lot of the people in the rural areas don't have the ability to necessarily have the benefits, that really becomes a big issue. So what happens with a lot of these people is the wife works at the First Call resolution while the husband works contract labor or something in the woods.
I appreciate that. If I could follow up.
Please do follow up.
Again, I'm supportive, but we have some call center employers in our area, and I know we've had them sprinkled throughout the state. But it's the wages are so low that oftentimes those people are on the Oregon Health Plan, or they're applying for other public assistance. And at what point do we say, okay, if you're going to get a tax break to this business, that these jobs have to pay and have to have benefits, or have to be in a place where the rest of the state is not in a position of subsidizing these employees? I mean, because while I know that any job is better than no job, that may be true, but at some point, call center jobs, to me, does not feel like an economic development strategy. Facebook is a great example. Green industry is another thing, but just any old call center that pays $8.50 an hour doesn't feel like economic development to me.
Madam Chair, if I may share a comment here, I think it's important to realize that not all call centers operate that way, and I think you know that. There are a handful that don't operate, you know, in the higher wage range. We've got one in our area that does operate in the higher wage range, and I could speak personally on this. My wife spent 5 years working there. At the end of her time, she was making $18 an hour, a full benefits package for the entire family for $95. We had 5 phone plans that we could receive as part of the employees. So it's important that you realize that it's not all call centers. I certainly recognize there are some that operate in that lower income spectrum, but if you were to look at all call centers across the state, there are certainly some that this enterprise zone benefit would affect positively and create positive family wage jobs in a community, and certainly in a rural community. When you add that benefits package, as my colleague had mentioned, that certainly adds a lot to the income. So it's important to look at that sum total of what the compensation is. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Happy travels on your way back to your 100 miles or more destinations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Now we'll take Jackie Roth, Jack Roberts, and Ray Burstead. Welcome. Why don't you go ahead?
Okay, sounds good. Thank you, Chair Burdick, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jackie Roth. I serve as legislative assistant to Representative Betty Comp, who represents House District 22, which includes the cities of Woodburn and Jervis, as well as Northeast Salem. The following is testimony I will be presenting to you on behalf of Representative Comp, who unfortunately could not be here at this time. She does send her apologies. Excuse me. Before you today is House Bill 3017, which would extend the sunset for Oregon's Enterprise Zone program to the year 2025, and I apologize, my voice has been coming and going today. While everyone has felt the impacts of this global recession, some districts have been particularly hard hit and require as much investment as they can possibly get. Representative Comp's hometown of Woodburn is economically disadvantaged even in good times, having per capita income that is lower than the state average. That is why we need to continue enterprise zones here in our state. Not only do these zones provide important tools for cities and communities to use in retaining and attracting new employers, they can help existing businesses be successful as well. Recently, the city of Salem was not only able to retain the business of garment manufacturing, saving 157 jobs, but this business was also able to upgrade their local facility, adding 67 additional jobs. This may not seem like a lot, but in this economy, it is significant. As Representative Comp says, now more than ever, every job matters and every job has the potential to impact Oregon's standard of living. I submit to you on behalf of Representative Comp a letter from the city of Woodburn telling their story of what these important zones mean to their economic development. In addition, we will be submitting a letter from the Association of Oregon Counties and the League of Oregon Cities outlining what good this program does to state. When considering this issue, we encourage you to keep in mind the importance of helping all Oregonians, especially in these tough economic times. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Roberts.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the executive director of the Lane Metro Partnership, which is a nonprofit economic development agency that was formed by the city of Eugene, Springfield, and Lane County back in 1985. We use the Enterprise Zone down there a lot. We have a number of them, both our major cities, Eugene, Springfield, have enterprise zones, as do some of our smaller communities like Cottage Grove and Junction City and Florence, Oak Ridge. We found it to be a very effective tool, but I understand there's a problem with trying to prove that the companies wouldn't have come there or, in the case of existing companies, wouldn't have expanded anyway. It's sort of like poker. Once you've thrown your hand in, the other side doesn't let you know whether they were bluffing or not. And so the only way we would know is if we didn't give them the incentives, they didn't come. And even then, it's hard to know what makes a decision. I think there's another way to look at it, though, that is helpful in evaluating whether this is a good tool for local governments to have. And it really has to do with particularly the capital-intensive investments where the payoff and there, for the company and therefore the lost revenue for the local governments and schools, if in fact they would have come anyway, is the greatest. Those companies, generally speaking, have a large tax bill but place relatively little cost burden on service delivery for the community compared to the tax they pay. In other words, the large manufacturers, the high-tech, the companies that are really getting large benefits are a windfall to the local governments. The taxes they pay far exceed the additional costs, unlike a lot of housing developments or other commercial developments where your service delivery costs eat up a lot of those tax receipts. It only makes sense for local governments to be able to say, we're willing to give up a bit of that windfall for the long term. I compare it not to a subsidy, but to whether it's a JCPenney or the car dealer or someone else who says, you come down and buy today and there'll be no interest, no payments for 6 months. They don't do that because they want to lose money. They do that because they want to make the sale. And the same thing's true with us. When we give up some tax receipts in the short term, we generally make them back. Best example in our community of a company that unfortunately in the economic crash shut down, but Hynix, which is extremely controversial in our area. And there are people to this day who bemoan all the money we quote-unquote gave away because it was like a $1 billion investment. And it spread out over several years. And because of the high wages they pay, they were able to qualify for the 5-year enterprise zone investment. Yet after all those giveaways, they were the highest property taxpayer in Lane County. In fact, there were a number of years where in Eugene, they paid more property tax than the next 9 largest combined. In 2008, they had to shut down. Last year, they were still the largest property taxpayer in Lane County with an empty building. We didn't lose money on Hynix. We didn't lose money on Sony when they came here, even though they found that when kids could download music cheaper, they could buy CDs, they shut down. But they were a catalyst for the whole development of that area. But even after their enterprise zone benefit ran out, they paid $250,000 a year in taxes. And today, it's occupied by an arm of Peace Health, which had been Oregon Medical Labs, now Peace Health Medical Lab. They have more employees than they had when Sony was at its peak. These investments are paying off. And I think that's how we need to look at this as an investment and as an opportunity for us to spur the activity we need. Now, I do want to respond a little bit to Senator Hess' comment about call centers, because that's always been a controversial area, too. These are not the Hynix level jobs. And by and large, although our pay scale, I think, is a little bit better maybe than Central Oregon, and we see anywhere from $11 to $14 being paid in call centers. It also depends on the type of call center. Royal Caribbean Cruise Line is a company that we recruited in part because of the Enterprise Zone. They built a beautiful building out there by the freeway, if you've seen east of I-5 and north of Beltline, and it looks like a ship, and they spent a lot of money. That's the rarity. Most of them look for existing buildings and try to go cheap. These guys put a lot of money into it. But they also are a company that has career paths. Most of their executives that we dealt with when we brought them here had started in call centers. They had helped work through that part of the business. Now, they were the ones working in that now, but they had a chance to move up. But the most telling thing to me was a story that Congressman DeFazio told when as you're getting ready to open, and he went to a restaurant that he often frequented when he's back home, and the waitress was so excited because she knew him had been there and said, "Oh, I'm so excited. This is my last day. I'm going to work at Royal Caribbean Cruise Line." He said, "That's the first job I will have had that pays insurance." And we've had other people tell similar stories. A lot of people move from the food service and other retail jobs, part-time jobs. It's a step up the career ladder. It's not an end where they want to be. But the other great story we have was when Symantec moved into an abandoned department store downtown, and they started with what I regard as sort of the bottom-line consumer call center. This is for the people who bought the home version of Norton Utilities, and they weren't calling up because they wanted to thank them for what a great software they bought. It's a tough job, and there are a lot of turnover, difficult, but they got their foot in the door there, and they kept expanding what they were doing and growing. Today, they have two 80,000-square-foot buildings out in Springfield. Actually, they took some of the land that was excess land Sony had bought. They're out by there. They have over 1,000 employees. They've now outsourced the basic consumer complaint call center. They're doing the more sophisticated responses from the corporate security jobs. They have employees that sometimes will get on the plane and fly to the corporate headquarters when they're under attack from some of these virus programs and other things. When they went out there, they qualified for the five-year enterprise zone because the average pay there is 150% of the average in the community. Now, I don't think they had that in mind when they came to our community, but we wouldn't have gotten them into the door initially if we hadn't started that lower-level call center work. So I agree with you that we're not going to build our future on call centers. If we're the call center state 20 years from now, we will have failed. But we also have found that we have a great workforce, a lot of people who are good. It's a lot of the culture of this area. People are friendly, the customer service, and we do far better at that than we do the telemarketing. But the other thing I'll tell you is that we always get a huge turnout when we have these vacancies, and nobody leaves a better job to go work at the call center. So from our standpoint, we think it's progress. But I do agree with you that that by itself is certainly not the answer. We need a diversified growth in jobs for people at all levels where they can better their economic condition, and we can close that gap between us and the rest of the country.
Thank you. I think we're going to invite you to our tax expenditure committee. you really get the paradigm on how we're trying to analyze these. Welcome.
Chair Burdick, thank you very much, and committee members. For the record, my name is Ray Burstead. I'm the president of the Strategic Economic Development Corporation representing Marion and Polk County. I am also the zone manager for the Salem Enterprise Zone. And I can, without equivocation, tell you that if we don't have enterprise zones, we won't be competing on a national basis for clients and companies moving into Oregon. Over the last 25 years, the enterprise zone program has created jobs, expanded wealth, and increased the long-term property tax revenues for many of our local communities. The enterprise zone program, in most cases, is the only incentive we have to offer companies wishing to expand here. There are special cases where the Betsy program or other programs come into play, but for the most part, it is the only thing we have to offer. And it's the neat thing about it is that it's administered by our local governments. The City of Salem is the sponsor. Marion County does all the application and approval process. So it really does involve our local governments, and they know when they're making these decisions to allow companies to be approved for an enterprise zone application that it's going to benefit them at some point. A couple of cases in point that I want to mention, Representative Comp stole some of my thunder in talking about Garmin, but I have another announcement about Garmin that since that expansion, they came to us a few months ago or several months ago and said that they were going to create a GPS technology service center for Garmin Industries. And they were going to do it probably in Olathe, Kansas, but gave us a chance, said, tell us what you can do for us, said Gore in the city of Salem and the Enterprise Zone. What can you do for us here in Salem? Long story short, the project was done here. They now have 85 new employees that have, since the first of the year, come into that program. They're all fully benefited jobs. My board of directors won't allow me to even consider an RFP if the employees do not receive full benefit packages. So a lot of the people that we recruit go off the plate early on in the process, because if they don't offer that, we don't offer them the incentive. So just in the last 2 years, we've had 6 companies within our enterprise zone expand that would have expanded someplace else had it not been for the enterprise zone. Kettle Foods is an example, $9 million worth of investment, only 16 new jobs, but those were going to California if it hadn't been for the enterprise zone. Another case in point, recruiting companies into the local area. Now, you're all well aware, I'm sure, of the success we had with the state of Oregon and other resource partners to recruit Sanyo Solar to Salem. That company now has 200 employees. They spent $84 million developing that property. Those 200 employees, they now actually have 205 employees. The average salary of those employees is 150% of the average manufacturing wage in Marion County. They're supplying in excess of $12 million of annual payroll into the Salem economy. That's huge. That payroll, any economist will tell you, elevates itself 2 or 3 times throughout the economy by the time you look to car dealers and people selling homes and the grocery stores and the movie theaters and the restaurants who benefit from those dollars. I guess the main thing to say is, and it's been reiterated here by every one of my colleagues, is that without the enterprise zones in Oregon, we are going to be bypassed. And I'll give you a perfect example of a client I'm working with today. The only reason they're in my office, the only reason they're in negotiations with the city, the only reason they're talking about a purchase land agreement for a site is because of the enterprise zone. Had it not been for the enterprise zone and the e-commerce overlay, we would not even have been, they wouldn't even have slowed down here. And this is a project that will invest in capital in our community in excess of $200 million. So it is critical. It's not just important. It's critical to our economy, to Oregon's economy, that we allow the enterprise zone system to stay in place. Thank you.
And thank you. Questions from the committee? Thank you all for coming. Ann Hannes, Jack Isselman, Bruce Allen.
For the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties. Enterprise zones are strongly supported by both urban and rural counties. You've been hearing some very compelling stories about how enterprise zones have been critical for attracting businesses and jobs around the state. We feel this has been a tried and true program that's been in existence for over 25 years. It's been one that has expanded wealth, created jobs, and enhanced long-term property tax revenue. This is also a program where even though it costs us property tax revenue, we've seen and realized the gains from having enterprise zones. At the same time, it's a program that, while authorized by the state reaps great benefits in terms of the revenue that's generated by these businesses that have come in because of the enterprise zones. So with that, on behalf of both Association of Oregon Counties, and you also see that the League of Oregon Cities has also joined us, along with Oregon Economic Development Association, who you'll hear from in just a minute, in urging your support for House Bill 3017. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Allen. I'm with the Portland Development Commission. I act as the manager for the Enterprise Zone in Portland. I also oversee our work with the industrial manufacturers, and I also oversee our real estate development section. So I get to see these projects from all sides, the users and the city, and how these projects are developed. And I've heard a lot of this many times, and so I'll try not to repeat myself or to repeat some of the things that have been said earlier.
And we do have your written testimony.
Thank you.
In front of us.
First of all, let me just talk about two points. First of all, what Portland's experience has been with the E-Zone program, and secondly, some of the additional benefits that we see that we bring to the city of Portland. In terms of the experience, since 1996, is this coming in and out, it sounds like? Since 1996, there you go. Since 1996, Portland's E-Zone program has leveraged over $1 billion and has created over 5,000 full-time jobs. And we find it, as other people have said, probably the most effective tool we have for incenting new investment or expansions, and sometimes it's the only incentive that we have. Secondly, the economy, even though the economy has been devastating lately, given the uptick recently, we are now working with firms that are looking at entering the program that represent more than $500 million of new investment, including some of the largest ones that you've heard about, including the solar power project. And third, I wanted to point out what we think is one of the most important features of the program, and that is that it is first pre-established by the legislature so that all the rules are known and they're fixed and they're set. And secondly, they're set up, or it has been set up for an extended period of time. The proposal before you, of course, is for the next 12 or 13 years. And that's important because companies that want to make an investment, either it's a new investment or expansion, sometimes these projects take 2, 3, 5, 6 years to be developed. So it's important to have the 10 or 12 years established that they know that this program is going to be there so that they can begin to plan. In terms of the additional benefits that Portland sees, and I know we do this as well as some other jurisdictions, we require what we call community contributions, which is kind of a give back to the city. So all of our firms that participate in the program are required to dedicate 15% of the value of their abatement back to the city. We use about half of that for job training for the people that are going into those programs, and we use the other half for what we call business development. And that is to provide working capital loans to small businesses in the area, supply chain firms and the like, and also to support nonprofits that do job training for other folks in the neighborhood. So again, to keep it short, I'll just say one more thing. We are seeing a number of exciting expansions and new companies that are coming in recently, again, because of the uptick of the economy. Names like UPS, Solo Power, Service Steel, Vigor Industrial, and Solaix, which is on their second expansion, and some of our companies are on their third expansion now, so it's really phenomenal to see. I'll just leave it at that since so many of the things have been said before, and be happy to answer any questions.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Any questions? We'll take Jack first. Sorry, Jack.
That's okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Hesselman on behalf of the Oregon Economic Development Association. You've heard from a number of our members here today, and I think they've done a very good job explaining the program. In summation, I'll just say a number of these tax abatement and tax credit programs that you're looking at in the Joint Tax Credit Committee, we attempt to get statewide impact from those programs. This is one where we can say we have that in place. 34 or 36 counties have enterprise zones, and you've heard from people from a range of geographies today. There are enterprise zones in Gold Beach. There are enterprise zones in Baker City. What the program allows local governments to do is set up something that works for them. Bruce spoke about how they use the enterprise zone to drive investments in workforce development. Local government can tailor the enterprise zone program to meet the needs of communities. In Hillsborough, there's a 10% local source requirement that enterprise zone participants have to achieve in buying goods and services for their businesses. So it's a program that's been proven over time to work in communities. They are able to tailor it and fashion it in a way that advances their community's interests, and we urge you to support Senate Bill 3017 and extend the sunset. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Now, questions for the panel?
I'm pretty well convinced, Madam Chair.
Okay. Doggone, we don't have it posted for a work session. Senator House, do you have any comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Landauer. There's nobody to come up with you, Mark. I'm sorry.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Mark Landauer here today representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon and apparently Sacrificial Lambs. So thank you very much. Just I've provided some written testimony. I'd like to highlight a few points, if I may. First of all, SDAO opposes House Bill 3017. Excuse me. And at the outset, I'd just simply like to point out special districts are solely reliant on property taxes and in some cases fees. So with that in mind, I'd like to outline a couple of the concerns that we have with this bill. Oregon enacted the enterprise zone legislation back in the mid-80s. At that time, I believe that there were only 10 authorized. Currently, there are approximately 59. At that time, the enterprise zones were primarily focused on trying to incent economic expansion in areas that suffered from high unemployment, generally rural areas. And our concern is that the program itself has really gone beyond its original intent. Currently, only cities and counties are eligible to seek and gain a designation of enterprise zones. They are given the unilateral ability to exempt those qualifying businesses from paying the property tax of other local overlapping jurisdictions. Of course, that includes schools, community colleges, and, of course, special districts. As a result, the ability of special districts that rely on that very narrow set of revenue streams to meet the needs of their citizens becomes increasingly difficult. We would, over the years, we have opposed this this program primarily because we have no say. We have no ability to have any input on the granting of property tax exemptions, nor do we have any ability to opt out of that. So one that is one of the primary reasons why we oppose this bill. If you look at Exhibit A that I provided for you on the back of my testimony, you'll note that special districts on the property tax pie chart only represents approximately 13% of the total property taxes that are collected in the state. Providing an opt-out for special districts, we believe, would have a negligible impact on the benefit of enterprise property tax exemptions. Furthermore, we have some concerns about some of the exemptions that have been provided in the past. A study that was conducted by the Legislative Revenue Office back in 2006 showed that the average property tax abatement per job was for a little north of $4,600 per year. However, there was one instance where this same study showed that jobs that were created in eastern Oregon cost property taxes, or the property tax cost was over $550,000 per job. We believe that if you go forward with this measure, there are a couple of recommendations that I'd like to just highlight. They all the recommendations are outlined in my testimony, but two I'd like to underscore. We would like to see all affected taxing jurisdictions have the ability to have input in the decisions of granting these exemptions, and we also believe that more specific data, for example, reporting, evaluation requirements, transparency ought to be built into the program. We believe that those requirements that currently exist are lacking and ought to be strengthened. Without providing an opt-out for special districts, further and more rigorous oversight and reporting. We cannot support the passage of this measure. However, we do believe that there are other alternatives that the legislature could consider that would incent the creation of new jobs and the expansion of existing businesses and attract new businesses. And those are also outlined in my testimony. And with that, Madam Chair, be happy to take any questions that you may have.
Okay, fire away, committee. Oh, yes, Senator Morse.
I'm glad they didn't want to hear it.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Sacrificial Lamb. Okay, that concludes our sign-up list. Is there anybody else who would like to speak on this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3017. Remind my last committee member that we have our committee on joint committee on tax expenditures tomorrow at 8:30 in this room. And with that, we are adjourned.